Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Mind Your Loaf, a podcast about taking action on your mental health. I'm Jason Byrne, and along with Irish mental health charity TurnToMe.ie, who besides helping us with this podcast, provide professional mental health support online, free to everyone in Ireland. And that can only be a good thing. This is part two of Paul Murr, psychotherapist, and he works in the Department of Psychiatry in Trinity as well. This podcast was so interesting, we had to have two parts. So this is part two of our part one. Enjoy the rest of Paul Murr.
And so is, just to flip into anxiety, which I'd love to get your opinion on that, because that's another huge thing that people suffer from. I know we're anxious about something that we're like, I believe that when I get anxious, I'm definitely doing that to myself. And if I want to stop the anxiety, I can stop it. But I don't notice it when it comes in, though. Do you know what I mean? I don't go, oh, I'm going to be anxious in 10 seconds. Literally, I'll just be thinking about something. Next minute, my heart rate goes up. I can't breathe properly. I'm like, and next minute, I'm going, what? I'm having a panic attack. I'm so anxious. Like, but is that, what are we setting off when that happens?
Do you remember I talked about this amygdala structure,
okay,
and the hippocampus? So they're actually two small structures in the midbrain. They're subcortical, and the hippocampus kind of regulates your thinking, calm mind, if you like, and the amygdala is the part of the brain that amplifies fear and processes emotion. So in terms of anxiety. There's two kinds of anxiety, okay. There's panic, and then there's what we call trepidative fear. So trepidative fear is about being fearful of an external situation that's threatening you, you know, that might kill you or might damage you, and that's more kind of fear anxiety. Now there's a debate in the literature and research around this.
Panic is it proper shitting yourself? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes.
Yeah. that's
part of it, yeah. Exactly.
It's like, Jesus!
Yeah. Part of that system is to get rid of whatever's in the bowels and to prepare you for fight or flight, yeah. So we have it for a very good reason. It's to protect us. And so anxiety is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's about learning what to do with the anxiety and learning maybe how to use it in terms of being able to kind of recognize it, feel your way into it, hold it, and think about it. That's ideally what should happen. And that's where you get that sweet spot between the amygdala and the hippocampus, between acting or thinking. So ideally, you need the optimal situation is where you can feel the fear.
Yeah. Okay,
and then think about a strategy to, you know, negotiate it in some way or avoid it or challenge it or whatever. And there are many different versions of that. The other type of emotion that's closely linked to anxiety is panic. Mm-hmm. And panic is associated with a different system in the brain, which is what's known as the panic grief emotional system. And so it's involved in attachment behaviors. And we feel panic when we are separated from an attachment figure. So
like our mother or something?
Usually our mom, yeah. And this happens to all mammals. We have a kind of a homeostatic set point within our biology of how close we need to be to our parents, particularly when we're young, because there's a huge kind of survival piece around that. We're so dependent upon them. We move away from them. It evokes in us what's called a separation distress response. And that only kind of is active for a certain period of time. And then you tip into what's called a despair phase. And the theory around it is that in evolutionary terms, when we were out in the savannah, we got separated from the tribe. It was good that they knew we were left behind, but only for a certain amount of time. After that, it was no longer an advantage. You were just signaling to predators that you were separated from the pack, and you were just announcing your presence to them.
But so
it became more evolutionarily adaptive. To actually quieten down, to downregulate that system, and that's linked into this idea of despair. If it's too persistent and pervasive, that kind of experience, that can lead to these kind of depressive episodes as well. You know, that constant experience of being separated from somebody and there being no hope of them coming back. And that happens. What's important about that is that happens at a very early stage in our development, or I should say, if that happens persistently at a very early stage in our development, it sets up a certain kind of template for the world and in the nervous system, where this how you respond to that is very much predicated on these early experiences, and that becomes a template then for romantic relationships.
Life. Well, I mean, let's say for example, like my dad, like he used to shout and panic over things, right? He never ever did anything else. Like he used to go, "Don't do that, Jesus! Don't touch that! No, don't be at that." He'd be like that this whole time. So when I was a kid growing up, I would be afraid like to jump into the sea with my mates because I thought my dad, if I did anything wrong. My dad had shouted at me, and I took that on nearly all the way. Even now, I'm 48. I still have a fear of doing certain things, but the background bit is, I think I'm going to get in trouble with my dad. Like that's basically the simplicity of it. I think if I go down, if I get in that roller coaster and it comes flying off the track, I think my dad's going to freak out. But like he's not. It's like so. Is that the attachment thing you're talking about, like that?
Because like they're, you know, for a very significant portion of your early life, your parents, for most people, are your universe. You know, they're your world, and you kind of absorb the rules around the world. And what's really important about that piece is that it's primarily affective rules, not cognitive. So you don't have the hardware to think your way through these things.
No,
you feel it. So you know your dad would roar or shout at you, put the fear of God in you.
Yeah.
You know that's enough. But you can't. Those systems are separate to your cortical systems that can think and speak. So there's a distinction there between what we call declarative systems, which are cortical, where we can talk about things, name things, and think our way through it. And then affective systems. So these memory systems, and there's a whole slew of them, are completely unconscious.
So is that why do we have to be so careful when we're raising our children? We're setting them up.
Yeah.
Loads of people, I'm a dad as well. I wouldn't be concentrating on every single thing I'm doing or saying to my kids.
Because
you'd be going, shit, what have I told them now? What have I told them not to do? What have I told them to do, you know?
That's not good either, you know. And even when you're talking about like words and, you know, like complicated sentences with young kids, like a lot of that goes over their heads anyway. And what really registers with them is the emotional environment. You know, and how you relate to them emotionally. That's the most important thing. But what I want to say to you, Jason, is that these systems, these unconscious systems, memory systems, are online and working from before birth. Okay, but our thinking systems don't come online till around 1.5 to 2 years of age, and even then they're only in a very rudimentary form. So we feel and we lay down emotional memories way in advance before we can actually think or have the words to describe them. Now that's where psychotherapy works, is in that space, because those systems don't just stop there, but they're with us. They travel alongside the cognitive systems throughout our development and throughout our lifespan. But what happens is that your responses, your emotional responses to situations, they get automated.
Yeah. Okay?
So they become an automatic response to a certain situation, like, you know, jumping into the sea or something, that kind of risk taking. Yeah. You have a visceral response, an unconscious response to that. Okay. Mm. And that gets laid down, and it's not accessible to thinking. You can't pull it up and think about it. It's a separate memory system, completely wow. separate. So what therapy allows you to do, and this can happen with trauma as well. So when people experience really traumatic situations, again, back to this system, the thinking system gets shut off, and the feeling system and the acting system gets privileged, as it were, and the experience doesn't get recorded accurately. It's probably mm-hmm. the best way to put it. But what therapy can do is can allow you to access those unconscious systems and put some thinking in around them. So it's a kind of a misnomer, like the where people say, you know, you kind of recover or uncover these repressed memories. In trauma and in early childhood, they're not repressed in the sense that they've been pushed away, or they just haven't been recorded. The hardware's not there to record them. And what therapy can do is can allow you to have a space where these experiences can be recognized, these patterns can be recognized, the feelings attached to them can be experienced in a safer place, and a different kind of thinking can be put in around it.
In other words, that's what people might refer to as baggage. Like they're holding a lot of baggage
exactly.
there,
exactly.
and they don't really know how to deal with the baggage.
Exactly.
And they just, and so therapy will teach them how to deal with the baggage. And so, because as you say, a lot of people, I know a lot of people that didn't even know they had baggage, and they were just constantly feeling shit.
And like, that's the way those memory systems work. They're unconscious. So therefore you can't know about them. And particularly the responses that you develop to threatening situations are unconscious. So you can have a feeling response to a stimulus in your current life, and have absolutely no idea why you're responding that way. And that's why the neuroscience of this is really interesting, because we know from neuroscience that there are these distinct and what we call dissociable systems. They don't need each other to work. They're separate systems, and they don't communicate with each other.
At all. That's amazing, because I just thought that it was all in one big system.
No, well, it is in a way.
But it runs parallel, kind of thing, you're saying.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And if your world and your experiences are mediated to you well enough by your caregivers, in other words, that they help you to put words and thinking on your inner experiences, to help you, which is what your therapist does. If that's done to a kind of a good enough extent, people can cope with most things, you know. But when it's not good enough, when there's neglect there, or when there's abuse there, the child doesn't have any chance of, you know, mentalizing these experiences. They stay in these non-conscious, what are also referred to as implicit memory systems.
But isn't it amazing though that something like abuse or whatever it stays in you forever? And and as you say, there's I've known people again who weren't sure if they were or not, but they're pretty sure they were. But so who's burying that? Are they burying that, or you're just saying they're just not able to record it when they're that young?
That's how we understand it now. You know that it's a difference between pushing something down.
Yeah.
And something being kind of split as it's coming in, if you like. You know, so this idea of dissociation you know, so people dissociating. And that's common in people who've experienced abuse, you know, yeah. that in some way to survive it, you experience, they dissociate their mind into another space, if you like.
Okay.
And then the experience doesn't get processed. But the really kind of significant thing about this is that, as well, is that when you look at, there's a kind of a standard diagram of memory systems in introductory psychology texts, and there's two branches, and one is explicit memory systems, which are conscious, if you like, and implicit memory systems, which are unconscious. We have two major branches within the conscious system, which is called declarative memory and semantic memory. So, sorry, declarative memory is the umbrella term, but within declarative memory, you've got episodic memory and semantic memory. Episodic memory is a memory for episodes that you were involved in, things that you can say, I was there, I did this, I did that. So things about you as a person. Mm-hmm. Then semantic memory is memory for facts, like Paris is the capital of France, you know, et cetera, et cetera. These memory systems, the declarative ones, are the most recently evolved. They're also the last systems to fully mature in human beings through their development.
No way.
So they're not fully formed until, so we think now, late 20s, possibly 30 years of age, when these systems are fully functional, these declarative systems, these cognitive systems.
That late? Like, nobody would think it's that late. We talk. Yeah. We, most of us think we're finished at 19, 20.
And it explains a lot of things for a lot of
people. It doesn't, it? Look at all the lads, especially the lads, we're all going, I knew it, I'm not finished. Because, like, I have a 20-year-old son who I just think he's probably not fully cooked yet. I know that's like it. But look, we've been talking for ages. Paul, I need to get to just one other quick thing.
Sure.
Because you do deal with a brain injury as well.
Yes.
And so just a question for you was, when someone, I know everybody suffers from, when they actually do have brain injuries, they're all different types of cases. But how does the repair work on the brain? Is that a thing? Like, let's say you damage 70% of your brain. Can you get any of that back? Do you know what I mean? Is that too broad a question? Because it's all different cases. Is there any way you could simplify that more down? Like, maybe.
So, I mean, it does depend on where the damage has occurred. So, if the damage occurs at the cortical level, you know, which might happen from maybe a kind of a traumatic injury, people might be lucky enough only to have damage to the cortical areas. The cortex is the most plastic part of the brain, and it can rewire itself pretty easily with a lot of help. You know, it's pretty plastic. Now, if the brain damage might have its source in a stroke, which really can involve structures in the subcortical part of the brain, structures that are close to the hippocampus that I talked about.
Yeah,
they can, through pressure, they can kind of explode, as it were, cause a lot of damage in the tissue. They're much harder to,
and they're just constantly bleeding and stuff.
They heal, and there's something like an 18-month period around which a lot of natural kind of organic healing can occur, and then after that, a lot of intensive work, cognitive rehabilitation work can be helpful. But what's often not addressed, and there's not a history of it being addressed in neuropsychology in general, but Ireland, unfortunately, is a bit behind the curve on this, is the emotional needs of the person. And that's where psychotherapy, and particularly the kind of psychotherapy that I practice, can come in, because the emphasis is not so much on the cognitive structures.
Okay.
The emphasis is on these unconscious systems that I've just spoken about. Mm. That most of them are still intact.
Because they're physically deeper in there.
Yeah, and they come out maybe in the person's emotional response. You know,
wow.
So there's a way in which these patients can use the therapist's mind, as it were, to make up for the bits that are missing in their own.
Well, there's, and I see another thing real quick, because my own grandmother, she got Now, she had Alzheimer's.
Yes.
So I watched it because other people listening as well will have like people who are suffering from dementia and Alzheimer's. And I watched this amazing, you might have seen this program. It was called How to Stay Young. And just to summarize it quickly, it was Angela Rippon that was doing it. And she visited an island in Japan called, I think it's called Okinawa. Like it's And it's got the most centenaries in the world on it. But they basically what the study was that they were eating this white vegetable, but it was a purple, you know, root, purple inside, so a purple food. They then found that their study was that a lot of purple foods helped with Alzheimer's and dementia. And then what they did was, and just see if you agree with this as well, they did a social experiment back in England with people of, you know, they weren't severely suffering from dementia, but they were showing signs of everything. So what they did is they got them into a social situation, made them play table tennis and stuff, laughing and talking and stuff like that. And then they did other people who just kind of just stayed on their own in their house.
Yes.
And then they had other people learning guitars. So all the older people that had learned how to play guitars and socialize were starting to fire all their neurons again, and their memory was coming back, and they were starting to do amazing things where they were told by doctors, no, they're totally, they're gone. They'll never be able to. So is that a thing? Like people who think they're like suffering, getting a bit doddery, as we call it. Is that a good thing to just try and fire the neurons again with some sort of task?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the key thing there really is community and social connection. We're hardwired evolutionarily to be social and to be in contact with people. That's what lots of people are finding so really difficult about the COVID situation.
Yeah.
Because we actually, when we go back to this idea of, kind of regulating our emotional systems. There's a way in which we regulate each other, you know, when we're in groups. And we can't.
Yeah, we make each other laugh and like it gets,
exactly.
It's exciting.
And what being in groups, in social groups, allows us to do is to, and listen, there can be a negative side to this, but to abdicate individual responsibility. You don't have to worry about yourself. You know,
yes.
if you're in a good group, a good friendly group, you know, you can kind of relax a bit, and that allows us to regulate our emotional systems. And again, it allows us to bring online, to downregulate, if you like, that kind of fear system, panic systems, and it allows us to open up that gateway into the kind of thinking mind again, to use that term.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening, you know. And when you encounter something new, there's a separate emotional circuitry in the brain called the seeking system. Sometimes it's called the reward system or the wanting system, but we tend to think of it now more as a general seeking system. So it allows you to explore your environment and become really kind of activated and enthusiastic about things. It's the same system that's activated by cocaine, by the way.
Right.
So it's a general kind of interest system. That system underpins all other emotional systems. So it underpins the play system. It underpins, a good attachment system, fear system, love system. All of these things are underpinned by the seeking system.
So your top tip there really is to try and socialize as much as you can. And like we all do try and go and see our old parents.
Yeah.
We haven't been able to do it as much.
Yeah.
But and as Irish people, I mean, Irish people especially, I'm not saying the rest of the world is any, but we are very sociable people as Irish people. And my own mother, like just to say during the COVID, when Dad passed away, she was on her own. I definitely noticed a bit of dodderiness, right? Little bits, right?
Yeah.
Then my sister eventually moved in, and my mother is completely different.
Yeah.
She doesn't forget anything anymore. She just asked me what I was doing, like bang, 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 because she's in a happy social situation again.
Yeah, and being in close contact to people that we love does release endorphins in us, and these endorphins again help to down-regulate these fear systems and upregulate our moods.
Yeah.
You know, and we become more alive, more awake, more interested in things. So that's a big thing about as well, about people having interests, developing interests for themselves, you know, and constantly challenging themselves. Because that stimulation is what, in a way, what kind of keeps us alive, you know, being interested in things.
And so, but do you believe that vitamins help as well? Because I've got a load of vitamins out there, and I don't know if they're a placebo or what's going on.
I'm not sure, Jason. It's not my area. I don't know.
I know. Yeah.
But you know, I imagine it does link into that.
You know, your fish oils.
Eating. Well, I think there is some pretty good research around the fish oils.
Yeah.
Piece, you know, and again, it's about that might be linked to inflammation. So remember the study I told you about the toddlers and the and the cortisol and the enamel in their teeth. It's inflammation that causes that, you know.
Okay.
So it's these inflammatory pathways that can, again, interact with your hippocampus and dampen down its ability to think and walk. You know.
So basically, right, so, so now I'm going to talk to you for nearly an hour, Paul, which is...
I'm so sorry.
I just, because what you deal with and what you do is like, I don't think there's any way to ever end how you can talk about this stuff. It just goes on on, and you open up another corridor.
We probably should have had a conversation about that before we started.
No, this is brilliant. I actually got nearly everything else I wanted to talk to you about. But just to summarize, like the best way to look after our brains... Do you know what I mean? Is, you know, what would you... You had your four pointers of looking after... I mean, like, just to summarise, as I leave here, I'm walking out of your room, like, what's good exercise for my brain now to keep me kind of steady?
I might even summarise it further than that. In terms of... I think one thing that everybody could do is to become more aware of what feels good in their lives and what feels bad, and to try to get more of what feels good into your life and less of what feels bad out of your life. Now, that's easier said than done, but I think developing the capacity, you know, to put yourself first and to really try to discover what you're interested in and what makes you happy.
Yeah, and it's okay to be selfish.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? A lot of people think that's not a good thing, but it's okay to look after yourself.
It's more than okay, it's necessary.
You know? Yes.
Then you can start to look after other people, you know?
Yeah, it's like the oxygen mask, isn't it, on the plane?
A little bit, yeah. That's the whole T-shirt expression, yeah.
Well, look, Paul, thanks a million for talking to me. I feel like there should be a part two, part three, even drop into Trinity, into one of the lectures.
Yeah, no, you're more than welcome, Jason, anytime.
Oh, you've been very good. Listen, Paul, thanks a million. And everybody listening in, that's just so much information and so, so, so handy.
Okay, that was Paul Moore. Thank you, Paul, for that amazing advice. So much stuff in there. It had to be in two parts. What a great guy. And now we all know how the engine works. We're all driving the car and Paul has just told us how the brain or the engine is working all the time. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for coming on. Mind Your Loaf. You have been listening to Jason Byrne and this has been Mind Your Loaf. If you like this episode, please subscribe and tell your friends. And don't forget, if you or somebody you know is going through a tough time, there is professional mental health support online, from counselling to support groups, all available for free to anyone from Ireland at turntome.ie. Mind your loaves, everyone. Turn to Me provides professional mental health support
online. Jason, do your, your ad voice.
Oh, yeah, I'll do the ad. Yeah. Okay, I'll do a proper ad thing. Okay, ready? Yeah. As a registered charity, Turn to Me provides professional mental health support online for anyone in Ireland going through a tough time. From one-to-one counselling to group and peer support, Turn to Me is accessible from any device anywhere in Ireland. If you would like to support Turn to Me, you can donate €4 by texting Turn to Me to 50300. Text costs €4. Turn to Me will receive a minimum of €3.60. Service provider like charity. Helpline 07 6680 5278.
Is that you?
Yeah, that was actually me. Okay. There.